on 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Johnny B, Johnny Schmacks, thank you both very much for taking us through this afternoon. It is Thursday the 2nd of June. I'm Shane Dawson and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, David Snaid is in studio to talk association football as the Irish under-21s and the men's senior team build up to a host of big games. And of course, we'll look back on the Ukrainian heroics last night at Hampden Park.
Obviously, of course, everyone knows the situation right now in Ukraine and every single game for us is like a final game. But to be fair, we have dreamed like a team to be on the World Cup. So we have one more game, one more final, and we need to win it. We need to take it. Otherwise, this game is not going to mean anything.
In golf, Greg Allen will be joining us to discuss the Irish in major action this week at the US Women's Open, plus the latest on the big names being attracted to the Saudi-backed golf league.
Within the hour, the Saudi-backed league LIV Golf released its field for the first event scheduled next week at the Centurion Club just outside of London. There are 42 names released today, and the highest-ranked player, well, it is a bit of a stunner. Let's take a look. It is former world number one and 24-time PGA Tour winner Dustin Johnson, who...
Will be interesting to get Greg Allen's thoughts on that. Plus, in horse racing, Jane Mangan joins us a day early to preview a massive couple of days at Epsom. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can do so by texting us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there. It is great to have your company wherever in the world you are tuning in from. Shane Dawson here. David Snaid is sitting across from me. And before we chat, David, a couple of news headlines to get through. This might actually interest yourself, David. Kerry Football Club has been accepted into the club licensing process by the Football Association of Ireland, paving the way for senior football to be played in the county next year. The club has been backed by former league player Billy Dennehy, who hails from the Kingdom, and American-based director Stephen Conway and Brian Ainscough. More on that in a few moments with David, as I alluded to there. Sligo Rovers have appointed John Russell as their new senior men's manager. First team assistant manager Russell had taken charge of the side on an interim basis after the departure of Liam Buckley. His contract as first team manager will run until the end of 2023. The EPCR have announced that 5 South African clubs will play in European competition next season. The Stormers, Bulls and Sharks, who qualified second, fourth and fifth from the URC, will play in the Champions Cup, while the Lions, who finished 12th, will play in the Challenge Cup, and the Cheetahs, who have not played in the URC, have been invited into the event, organisers saying their inclusion will bring a new level of elite rugby. In tennis, world number one Iga Świątek had a straight set victory over Daria Kasatkina in their French Open semi-final. It finished 6-2, 6-1. Świątek clinched a 34th successive win and moved into her second Grand Slam final. Poland Świątek will meet America's Coco Gauff, who defeated Martina Trevisan in two sets, 6-3, 6-1, in this afternoon's other semi-final. As always, for more on those stories and all of today's sports news, you can download the RTE News app or log on to the RTE Sport website at rte.ie/sport. David Snaid, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you? Keep on.
Yeah, all the better for chatting to you. Let's just get straight into soccer, association football, whatever you want to call it. I mentioned Kerry and Sligo Rovers news. As always, we'll be pushing and planting the League of Ireland flag. We will get to that shortly, but I want to start with last night's match. Scotland 1, Ukraine 3. Ukraine manager Alexander Petrikov, who came out with some brilliant quotes, very emotional and very heartfelt quotes before the match and likewise after the match. He said, "This victory was not for me or for the team members. It was for our country. This was a huge victory for Ukraine, for the people watching them back home, the armed forces in the trenches, the people working in the hospitals. They say thank you to us and we say thank you to them." So a hugely emotional occasion. And now they'll have to harness that energy again come Sunday for a playoff final against Wales for a place in the World Cup.
I know. Like, it kind of, even just watching that, when you're kind of listening to the words you said there as well, and you kind of, you see some of the stuff that's come straight to mind as you see what's happened with, say, Zinchenko, and some of the moments that he's had recently, kind of just like great joy, obviously winning the league with Manchester City, and he's draped with, obviously, Ukrainian flag, and he's just, remember, he did that interview with Sky Sports on the pitch, and it's just extremely affecting. And like, it wasn't that long ago, I remember we were in here and there was like the fans, the Ireland fans and the Ukrainian fans who were organising the fundraiser out in Home Farm, and it was just one of those times where like fans who travel the world together and develop friendships, which is what happened when you go away with football. I think people kind of see like what happens now with football fans going away, and the football's obviously a very big part of it, but when you're travelling and supporting a team and doing all that, it's much more than just going to watch a match. Like, it really is, it's part of your life, and that's what we're seeing with, say, Ireland fans who travelled over and still had those relationships with the Ukrainian fans and were able to help and provide some support. And then when you hear the manager of the Ukrainian team talking like that, and it's just a kind of reminder, like, it's easy to say, oh well, you know, sports, what's that, the phrase, like, sports is the most important or the least important things, or something like that, and it kind of, but like something like this,
it's
when
not a matter of life or death, it's much more important.
Yeah, that's Bill Shankly, isn't it?
And
but something like this, it kind of just reinforced that a little bit about that sense of pride in terms of just providing some kind of joy and a little bit of a relief. And like, for us, like, it's very difficult to even comprehend what's going on there now at the moment, and the fact that it's still going on. You know, like, it was a while ago where it was dominating everything, and it's still obviously in the headlines, but it kind of makes you can't forget what's happening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's very easy to just go on with life and say, well, everything else is grand in your corner of the world and all the rest of it, but when you see how it's affecting those people, and when you see those players and how they react, and I was just even listening to Zinchenko, and pretty sure was the clip he was playing
was,
there,
yeah.
And he's talking, it just kind of reminds you about how he's wired, where he's feeling that emotion, and he's talking about what's happening in his home country, and yeah, he still realises that pressure, and that the fact that he's talking about, well, this match means nothing if we don't actually win on Sunday. For them, you kind of wonder, just being able to have that to channel, and that emotion and that energy, that's what they're obviously now working towards against Wales. Like, it's going to literally be Wales, and obviously against the world, really.
Yeah, similar to that, I think that Andy Robertson was saying as well last night before the match, that it was a case of everyone wanted Ukraine to win, and you could see, listen, it was a hugely emotional occasion.
And you see the resolve, I think you have to be admired, you know what I mean? Like, like, that team was a team that was cobbled together from all over, and you know, haven't been able to properly train. Like, it wasn't so long ago, I don't know if you remember this, it wasn't so long ago that League of Ireland clubs were getting emailed a list of Ukrainian players who were in leagues in, say, Russia as well, or in Ukraine, who would be available, who would be in a way, just because they just wanted to get players out of their country. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I did an interview with Dave Webster, who plays for Finn Harps, and this just shows you as well about how football can just like stretch and just make the world so small too. I did an interview with Dave Webster and Bastian Hirdy when I drove up to Ballybofey with them from Dublin, and Dave Webster's wife is from Ukraine.
Okay.
And this was at the very beginning when stuff was beginning to happen, and like, she was talking about, oh, sorry, David was talking about his wife in the article, how she was getting in touch with her dad and uncles who are in the Ukraine. Now, at that point in the part of the country where they were, it wasn't quite as that kind of entrenched in what was happening, but like, it just shows you there, like, you know what I mean? Like, she was going through an absolutely terrible time, and then you had Dave Webster, who still obviously again just suffered a really bad injury, which is like his whole season now is gone, but was travelling up just helping to try and make a living to go travel from Dublin up to Donegal, and yet his wife is dealing with this, and you saw the kind of impact that it was having on them, and even just listening to some of the stuff he was saying was extremely affecting, to be honest.
Yeah, no, it is, and there's so many stories like that, and people will obviously know your Zinchenkos and Mikulenkos and Malinovsky and Yaremchuk, who were playing in major European leagues. But I think there was an article on the Independent, the match preview about yesterday, of some of the players waking up at 5 a.m. and trying to find shelter, you know, months ago, and that's still obviously taking up a huge part of your brain when you're trying to go play a football match. Even the manager Petrikov looked to take up arms, and he was told, no, you're not, go back and bring us to the World Cup, that's your mission for the country as well. So yeah, listen, it will be very interesting. See, even I think there were journalists tweeted yesterday that when Scotland-Ukraine kicked off, there were air raid sirens in Lviv in Ukraine. So as we say, it does dominate news headlines, but it's still an ongoing issue, obviously. Like, it's always difficult to segue in talking about the football side of things, but there is the matter of the 90 minutes of football. And of course there's Irish interest because both Scotland and Ukraine are in Ireland's Nations League group. So I suppose looking at the match itself, Ukraine could, Scotland poor, is really, if you want to really simplify it.
Yeah.
Would you be concerned of how good Ukraine were, and would you be confident then that Ireland should be able to do a job from Scotland, judging on that 90 minutes of football?
Yeah, listen, it's going to be extremely tough regardless of both games. Mm. If you look at it, like, kind of, the Gordon have a very tough game themselves, obviously, on Saturday. That's going to be kicking off proceedings for them. And then, like, you kind of, it's really important from Ireland's point of view, it's imperative, really, that they get off to a good start. There's obviously so much momentum, and that's really going to be the thing that'll snowball. Like, if Ireland get off to a bad start, then obviously there's going to be more pressure. And then by the time the game comes around against Ukraine on Wednesday, and then obviously Scotland the following week, like, at the moment, it's more so a case of, and it's probably a good thing from Ireland's point of view, it's making sure that house is in order themselves. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so much change, obviously, so much change has happened over the last year and a half under Stephen Kenny.
But is this the time now that we have to see the change? There's only so much time that a team can gel together and come together. Yeah. Surely we've had that period.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And that's what's been said over the last while, even from Stephen Kenny too, where he's saying about this is now the time where some of those plans that have been put in place already, and the forward thinking needs to actually have action now. And that's obviously a given. Like, if you're looking at it from a point of view of purely from a football perspective, and you said there about, well, it's difficult to segue in, but if you're looking at it coldly, you are kind of thinking, well, like, Ukraine have had an amazing game last night. They're going to have an extremely difficult match at the weekend, and one way or another how that's going to affect them is massively going to be drained, because they're either going to qualify for the World Cup and be on an absolutely unbelievable high, and basically, let's be honest, that next week for them really pales into insignificance, because they've literally achieved something that could be beyond comprehension considering what's happened to their country. But then you're looking at it from Scotland's point of view, there's, like, players there who've had long seasons. It's kind of that little bit of a derby game, isn't it? Because a lot of players will know each other as well. But then they'll be coming to the point, I think they have Armenia on Wednesday as well, don't they? So, like, that's their chance, early chance, to get back on the horse a little bit and to actually kick back in and say, well, do you know what? They're not going to suffer too much of a fallback from it, because there's been a lot of positivity about Scottish football too over the last one under Steve Clarke. He's come in and he's injected a fair bit of positivity, and look at the squad and the players on paper that they have, and you say, yeah, they're better than Ireland.
I think they just set up wrong, really. They had to take off Lyndon Dykes at half time, bring on Ryan Christie as well, and I think Ali McCoy's made a comment on Sky Sports on commentary that's like, that might seem negative, bring on in a midfielder when you're chasing a goal and so on, but they just needed to get more on the ball, really. So it's about how they set up, and that's, obviously, they'll be setting up different against Ireland.
That's the point Eavan is making. Sorry, trying to allude to it a bit earlier, I was saying, if you look at how Ireland kind of seem to be at that point where there doesn't seem to be too much tinkering now. You can't imagine, you kind of have an idea of how they're going to play, that there's going to be obviously a bit of speed either side of maybe a Callum Robinson kind of linking things through the middle. You kind of know, well, obviously Josh Cullen's going to be suspended for the first game, so that's going to be a big issue, so he'll be back in afterwards. But you kind of have an idea now of how Ireland play with the kind of the two haulers, the lads in front. It's going to obviously be the wing backs. It's going to be, so you kind of know now what's expected of Ireland, and yet they do have the ability to be able to mix it up a little bit with Scotland, if they're kind of at the stage now where, because of post-season and all the rest of it, and players might have little niggles and players might not be able to come through the next couple of games, where they could be, as you say, kind of, there could be square pegs and round holes. That's where, as well, the onus comes on Ireland, especially playing at home in that game, to actually take the game really to them and be able to show that they have the ability to not just play football, but to have that killer instinct a little bit as well, because that's kind of how it's been. Like, you look at it, like, the goals that have been scored and been done it against weaker teams, now it's the challenge to do it against teams who are kind of on your level. It's the whole point in the Nations League, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, you can't look at this thinking, oh well, we're playing against teams who are far superior or far less. Like, this is one of the benefits of why the Nations League is so important for countries like Ireland, because you are in a group where you know you're against teams who are on the same level of you, and you should be able to kind of gauge where your progress is at, because if you're beginning to actually look, do you know what, we're actually on a fair footing, then you get a sense of your progress as well, which is, it's going to be really important, especially now that Stephen Kenny has that contract, and a bit of that kind of talk about, well, this game is so important, blah blah blah, now it's a case of actually seeing that progress married with the results. Like, you made the point, wasn't it, after I think it was at near the end of the last campaign where he goes, well, Ireland, we want to win the Nations League group. That's our aim. Obviously, not that you're all back on it, but then he kind of comes back and says, well, that's the aim, that's the target, and of course it is. But even to hear the manager and even to have a kind of a belief in the system where that's where you're aiming for, when Ireland haven't even won a game in the Nations League yet, and it was seen as almost like an afterthought. Yeah, if you do well in it, you've got a European playoff. If you win the group, you've got a European playoff spot. It's going to be very difficult to do it, but at least you're going into a group and you're going into a campaign with that aim and those goals, and you have that kind of attitude, and that's kind of the message filtering around. You're starting from a good base, and we'll see on Saturday if that's where the players are at.
Well, it's four matches in 10 days, so they are coming thick and fast. As you mentioned, it's Armenia at Saturday, 2 p.m. Next Wednesday at 7:45, Ireland hosts Ukraine, and then they will host Scotland on the 11th of June before taking on Ukraine away. That match will be in Poland on Tuesday the 14th. You mentioned Josh Cullen is suspended, so one man that might step up and we might see a big performance over the next couple of matches is Jason Knight, and he was up in front of the media.
Obviously everyone knows it's been a tough year with the things behind the scenes at Derby, but again, I've played my part, I've played a lot of games, so I was happy in that aspect. But what the future holds, I don't know for now. Like I said, I've still got a year left, so we'll see what happens.
But from your Irish prospect point of view, getting in Stephen Kenny's team, I guess you'd want to be playing at the highest level possible.
Of course, yeah, it's a really competitive squad we've got now, and you need to be playing football at the highest level you can, and that's something for me and the manager to talk about, but at the moment I'm still here.
That game against Luxembourg, the impact you made, was that your best moment in an Irish shirt so far?
Yeah, I think they're all very important games, and I think I had a good impact in that game, but that's something I need to continue doing, add more assists, add more goals, and that's something I'm going to try and do this coming campaign.
It's always interesting when international matches are played directly after the end of seasons. I'm not going to say the end of football because the League of Ireland continues, but the likes of...
I was ready to jump across the desk to the air, I was.
My phone, the WhatsApp groups would be lit up. No, but the likes of Jason Knight and other players as well, that they're trying to concentrate and play in international football, but also behind the scenes, I know they have agents to look after these things as well, but they are concentrating on new deals and where their club football might be for the season ahead.
And that's just the nature of football. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so much the mechanics of what's happening behind the scenes, as you mentioned. Like, it wasn't so long ago that Jason Knight was linked with Newcastle United. We're in from there was talk of Leeds United. Obviously, Marcelo Bielsa just loves those all-action kind of energetic players. It's funny, obviously, that game against Luxembourg that's mentioned, where you want an insight into the great tactical mind and the great kind of powers of persuasions of Stephen Kenny when he was bringing Jason Knight on. He literally just whispered into his ear, just be brilliant, when he was going on.
So he's like, not wrong.
And in fairness, like, he delivered. It's three assists, wasn't it? He set up three goals. But then he showed that point where, and this is what I mentioned with Josh Cullen being out injured, but Josh Cullen obviously is more of the anchor in midfield, and he's kind of shown about that ability to be able to actually dictate play a little bit. Like that game away out in Portugal, watching out with Ferrero, there was some of the passing and the movement he was getting into, and just the awareness and the speed of thought, and just everything about his performance in that game just really kind of was like, you know what, that was a moment where you kind of sensed he'd gone up a level a little bit and was actually made that jersey his own. I don't think Jason Knight is quite at that in terms of the ability to be able to kind of control a game a little bit. I think his game is still energy, it's getting into the box, it's about maybe up and down, because he can do different jobs obviously as well, either side. It's about providing just that injection of pace. Like, I remember being at his debut for Derby County, lucky to be over, and it was just one of those things where it just worked out. I don't think he was even expected to play. It was obviously before COVID, and it was against West Brom. Darragh O'Shea actually was on the previous day at the West Brom training ground and speaking to Darragh O'Shea, because he was beginning to emerge obviously under Slaven Bilic. And after the game, just going to the press officer at Derby, I was like, oh, can I just grab a quick word with Jason? And he was like, oh yeah. And he brings him out and he's like, he literally looked like a 7-year-old. He was like in his flip-flops, he was still drenched in sweat, and he was having a chat, and he just seemed like a little kid. But like, when you watch him play, he just has so much courage, and it's what everyone talks about. Like, there was a great story about just when he comes back and he went in to watch Cavan Teely, because obviously like his family would be from around that area, and he would have like his brother Kevin, who obviously went over and played in England and then came back and would be in the league. And there was a story told that he went in and was given out to lads because he conceded a late goal, and this is like the senior team of Cavan Teely when obviously you were still in the first division. He has that attitude and that mentality that I think really just, I think just managers want their round. It's the reason why, I had this made this point before about Frank Lampard gets a lot of stick from people, but like in years to come, we'll be looking back and Frank Lampard's willingness to throw Jason Knight in at Derby County will be a big moment because he's really kind of just shone and kicked on from there and it kind of followed on. Obviously, Wayne Rooney made him captain for a time and he's been in.
Wayne Rooney also nearly ended his career.
I know, yeah, with a tackle, yeah. But it just like he's just one of those players who. Again, kind of went through what's kind of happened, kind of not that it stalled because obviously the stuff that's gone on with Derby County and the administration and the fact that he could have went obviously in the January transfer and obviously I think he showed a bit of loyalty too. But he's just one of those players who he's nowhere near the ceiling yet of where he can get to. So it's that next move which needs to probably happen because I don't think League One needs to be for him. Like Derby's a huge club and they'll obviously be challenging. Wayne Rooney seems to be sticking around, which would be good for him, but I think he's at a point where he needs to have a good move, and whether it's higher end of the Championship or even possibly as in the Premier League, as it wasn't so long ago, Crystal Palace were even in and around, and Patrick Vieira, you look at some of the work Patrick Vieira has done and kind of overhauling the kind of
and for a midfielder to be learning off Patrick Vieira as well.
Well, absolutely, but then also the fact that if you look at the obviously Palace are going to be losing Conor Gallagher, he's gone back to Chelsea, but just the way players seem to thrive under Vieira, it seems to be a case of he actually seems to give us that platform and give them that it seems like I'm talking him into a move to Crystal Palace here that may not be happy. He was linked to them a while ago and there was information, but like it's just one of them where you kind of hope that like players' careers, sometimes it can hinge off certain decisions on how a move goes, and so you just hope the next environment he goes into will be the right one for him.
Well, I wonder how he's getting on in training, because the FAI haven't put any social media videos out, because I'm delighted to say it's all about the goalkeeper content. That's the content that we've been crying out for years. Mark Travers pulling off ridiculous saves, never mind his Bazunu Kelleher conversation. FAI content, fair play to the FAI media officers for pushing the goalkeeper narrative.
There was a great moment. I was at the under 21s this week, and Brian Maher, there you see, he obviously goalkeeper, but come through the ranks obviously with the under 8 systems in Ireland, and he was put up alongside Gavin Kilkenny and Conor Coventry on Monday, and we were chatting to Brian for a while, and he was like, great talk, I'm very confident. He was talking about getting a bit of stick off Andy Lyons, the fact that obviously like Derry had previously been top of the league and have blown a bit of a lead, and looks like Rovers now should be alright. But we were talking to him for about 10 minutes or so, and then no one had kind of addressed the elephant in the room, and in fairness one of the journalists just turned to him and said, how are you going to get into the senior squad? How are you going to get in? Like what's how's, because like obviously Mark Travers, you've Caoimhín Kelleher and Gavin Bazunu. Bazunu could potentially be playing Premier League football next season. Caoimhín Kelleher, according to Jurgen Klopp, is the best number two goalkeeper in the world. Mark Travers will be playing Premier League football next year. I think he was voted best goalkeeper in the Championship last season. So,
and Bazunu was left out of the League One Team of the Year, much to the dismay of the Pompey manager.
I think there's a Portsmouth fan still chained to the gates of the EFL in protest with that.
Probably that bloke with the, you know, that Pompey fan with the bell.
He changed his name to Portsmouth FC, didn't he?
Listen, I want to chat under 21s, because you mentioned you've been on media duty following Jim Crawford around, and we can hear from Republic of Ireland under 21 boss Jim Crawford now.
Yeah, ability, belief. I think there's a lot of players that want to sort of show how good they are, because there's been a lot said about nine under 21s players who've been promoted to the senior team, and I think there's quite a number of players that are involved in the group now, having spoken to them all numerous times, that that's where they want to go, and they see that there's a visible pathway for them to get to the senior team, and if they can come to the 21s and you know, put in positive performances and then go back to their club and build on that, there's every opportunity that they can get called up into the senior squad. And so I think it's there's a real drive, appetite, and, you know, sort of, you know, bulletproof determination that where they want to go. And as I said before, we've had sort of instances with players that they have been in camp and then they get the call for the senior team, and you know, their eyes light up and they're delighted to go, and that's everybody's ambition, you know. As soon as they start kicking a ball, they want to play for the senior international team, and that's what I get from this group. They're all driven, you know, the ability is there, you know, fantastic team ethic, work ethic, and you know, it's a privilege to be the head coach of this group of players and the staff.
The ability is there, says Jim Crawford. 51552 is the text number. Paul from Sligo, I just want to read out a text because it's a general narrative, really, David, that the one thing he took out of the Scotland-Ukraine match is that we will find it very difficult to beat Ukraine, but we should be able to get better of Scotland. And that's the text coming in. Probably share those sentiments. But the 21's there. Jim Crawford talks about the ability they have. And you look at the squad, I mean, it's just a host of talent, which is great to see, this conveyor belt of talent coming through. A loaded question to you, David. Firstly, what excites you about this crop of players on the brink of qualifying for the first tournament? And also, you had a story on the 42.ie about a talented player who's not involved at the moment.
At the moment, yeah, Erling Cashin. It's kind of been bubbling for the last little while, where obviously he's like English qualified as well, but has, through the grandparents' rule, obviously qualifies for Ireland and getting involved. And I think they're trying to, he's been in with the camp training as normal. Obviously, again, another Derby County player who's kind of, again, come to the fore under Wayne Rooney, probably because of circumstance. And, you know, another opportunity, another kind of indication of a lad who can take a chance when it comes, which is exactly what you want. And, yeah, Jim Crawford spoke very well about him in terms of what he can offer. But, yeah, I think they're trying to get his passport through and get, obviously, that citizenship through and get it, basically the red tape, or the basically just fulfil the requirements through FIFA. So I think Jim Crawford was talking about people behind the scenes, the FAI, just basically working every hour pretty much to get things in order. And he's, and they're going to have it up until this evening, where they'll make the call for the game tomorrow, and then obviously you've got the bank holiday weekend to try and get it sorted before the game on Monday against Montenegro.
You think UEFA or FIFA officials work over bank holiday weekend, David? You're long enough in this game now to know better than that.
I'm not going to make a comment on that. I think he kind of, when I was out there, it kind of seems as if tomorrow could be a bit of a push, and then it'll be Monday. If he is going to be hopefully available. But you were saying about just what excites. It's more so a case of what's kind of at the end of this week, or 10 days for them, the possibility to make history again in Irish football, to be the first team to qualify for under 21's European Championships. And if you listen to some of the players, even from this week, but also look at how the campaign, where they've had little bumps in the road, they've had moments where probably were down, and probably people thought they were out when they obviously lost to Montenegro. They had that defeat against Italy as well, but they showed again, it's like this thing where talk about the Ireland teams, but they obviously showed character and resilience, but they showed immense quality, and they showed like serious like discipline and organisation, like to be Sweden home and away without conceding a goal. And the manner of it on the away game, where they rolled on luck, they got fortunate with a penalty that could have went against them. But the fact that, like, so often you in teams and games where you've watched Ireland under that level, they kind of get overrun a little bit. They kind of maybe look as if, you know what, it's just a bit too big for them a little bit. Like, they don't seem to have the same structure or the same plan as places as other countries. And I think that's why this group are important, because there's been squads before with the 21s where you felt as if lads are just thrown in because, not being bad about it, but lads are thrown in because they're playing the long game, try and get lads who qualify for Ireland but maybe don't have that proper commitment to it and haven't been around the mix, just because they might end up sticking around and getting a senior cap. Like, the players,
I think the communication, that's twofold. So the communication, particularly between Stephen Kenny and Jim Crawford, given their relationship, when Stephen was 21's manager, it's improved so much, and that's why we're seeing this proper pathway.
Yeah, and it was playing the clip there, the fact that Jim Crawford was talking, like the fact that Jim Crawford was talking about players now realise that there is that pathway, proper pathway there, and also that there is a bit more of a link in terms of what's being asked of them at that level, 21's level, is being asked of them when they go up, and they're going to be obviously going around and evolve with the senior setup as well. And it's just one of them where, like, at this moment with the Ireland team, like even earlier on today, where, like, obviously Jim was there too, and Leo Connor, who, it was only when he was talking about it, Leo Connor has made 75 appearances from the under 15 level to the senior level.
Longest serving underage international, I think I saw the FAI tweet out.
Yeah, but interestingly, he's not the most capped at under 21 level. This is the thing, because, like, he won he was part of the under 19 squad a couple of years ago that got to the semi final, and yet at that age also won under 21 player of the year. Okay. Like, he's one of them who, and he's only had the one cap because obviously one of these lads from Waterford who went to Manchester United, then ended up going to Celtic, obviously wasn't able to properly make the breakthrough, but it's kind of forging that career for himself now at Tranmere and in the lower leagues, but it's kind of getting that sense of the cut and thrust of what that level of football is all about. But he's an exceptional underage career in terms of the amount of games that he's been involved in, and this for him is so important. He was talking about like give up everything just to have a qualification. Do you know what I mean? And like that's why it's exciting. It's because like there's a lot of lads in this group, even though there's some new players in there, who just mean so much to
you. Yeah,
and you're going to buy into that.
It's exactly what you want. Like, yeah. You want lads that are going to play for the shirt, for, you know, excuse the cliche. So the 21s you mentioned there, so huge run of matches coming up. Tomorrow evening they are at home in Tala to Bosnia Herzegovina, and then on the bank holiday Monday in Tala as well they play Montenegro before the campaign comes to a close against Italy in Ascoli, I think that one is, on June 14th, by which point Ireland will hope to be in a playoff for qualification, qualifying for their first ever tournament, as you mentioned there. So yeah, listen, David Snaid, exciting times ahead. Unfortunately, we didn't get to chat about John Russell becoming the new Sligo manager, but sure, I'm sure we'll be chatting League of Ireland plenty over the next couple of weeks as the other football comes to a close. And of course, Women's Euros, not to forget, is on during the summer, but best of luck to John Russell. And will be interesting to see how the Kerry story develops with their licence into the League of Ireland. And it's great to see a regional spread in the league, but hopefully there's solid foundations, because of course we've seen the likes of Kilkenny, Monaghan, Kildare County fold, unfortunately. So Sinné, for our soccer chat, David Snaid, pleasure as always, but do stay with us here on Game On, because we're going to be chatting horse racing with Jane Mangan in a few moments time.
RTE 2FM on 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game On.
Racing.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On. It is great to have your company on this Thursday evening. And I'm delighted to say I can turn our attention to horse racing in the company of Jane Mangan. Jane, how are you?
I'm very well, Shane. A Thursday evening, we better tell the people, why are we talking tonight and not our usual slot tomorrow night?
I tell you, well, you've teed me up perfectly. You're an expert at this because, Jane, there are a big couple of days of horse racing to look forward to at Epsom, of course. And I know we usually go chronologically when we're chatting about the big races, but let's just dive straight in because it all starts tomorrow, but there's a big one on Saturday. So Desert Crown is a strong favourite to land the Epsom Derby, with Flat Racing's Blue Ribbon to be renamed in honour of the record-breaking serial winner Lester Piggott, who of course sadly passed away last Sunday. It's a field of 17, and Jane, as always, plenty to be excited about.
Yeah, super race, and it's good to have such depth. 17 runners, a strong Irish contingent, Aidan O'Brien saddling three, but it is the story of Sir Michael Stout feeling the favourite, I suppose. The Dante winner, he was also impressive. And tactics with 17 runners. What will happen? Where will riders go? Where will they slot in? Stone Age is the likely number one from Aidan O'Brien. Throw in Dunica's Tis the Deal. Booked well in advance of the race, Frankie Dettori. What an eye-catching booking he is. This race has a lot of depth, but will a star emerge? Because today, well, there have been some impressive trial winners, we're yet to see a wow performance. Hopefully we get that on Saturday.
Hopefully we get that. Are you expecting to get it?
I don't know. I think we might get a wow performance tomorrow in the Oaks, which is an ideal segue to tomorrow, because there's a filly in there called Emily Upjohn, who today has looked a class apart from her rivals, albeit she hasn't beaten great depths of quality. But we're going to find out tomorrow in the Oaks. She faces 10 runners, 10 opposition, 4 from Aidan O'Brien, Joseph Saddle, Tranquil Lady, and Tom Markran booked for her. But John Gosden and Aidan O'Brien between them have saddled 9 of the last 10 Epsom Oaks winners. And I'd be very surprised if between them they didn't add to that tally.
Okay, so you mentioned Emily Upjohn there at the Oaks tomorrow, of course, the daughter of See the Stars. Who else, I suppose, catches the eye, even each way shouts in terms of who we should be having a look at in the Oaks specifically?
Well, I thought Concert Hall was eye-catching in the Guinea Purge. Yes, she was behind Tuesday, who finished second. But her mother won this race in 2012, and Shami Heffernan rode her in 2012, and now she's riding Concert Hall. It would be a great story if Nashua for Holly Doyle, if she could become the first lady rider to win a classic in Britain, that would be a huge result. And not a foregone conclusion. Nashua is a very talented filly also from the John Gosden Yard. And Thoughts of June, I was impressed with her at Chester. Wayne Lorden takes the mount for Aidan O'Brien. And it's amazing. Aidan has four runners in there. Four of their mothers were all Group 1 winners. And two of them actually won this race. That'll tell you the depth of breeding in that race. I thought the Coronation Cup tomorrow, the 3:10, six runners, not unusual to have a small field for this race, but I don't think it's a vintage renewal. 2020, we saw Gaeaf beat Anthony Van Dyke in Stradivarius. In yesteryear, we've had Stanley Kasabi win it three times, Cirrus de Zegel, Dahlia Poor Swain, and Dale Amy. But this year, it looks pile driver. Frankie Dettori, he has three top mounts. He's the Lester Pickett of our time. And this year, he has three Group 1 rides over the 2 days. Three of them are nearly favoured. Pile driver, I think it's his race to lose. He won it last year, beating Al-Azi. Bonobo, yes, we don't know how good he is for Charlie Appleby, who's conquering every peak this year. But yeah, I'm thinking Frankie Dettori might be the man between Emily Upjohn, Tis the Deal, and Pile Driver. It could be a Dettori weekend.
Yeah, well, we should be really appreciative, I suppose, that we're able to witness. I was chatting yesterday as well about the talents in tennis with the likes of Djokovic and Nadal. Being able to see these athletes and these superstars at their prime, it is a pleasure across the board. I do want to just mention high definition in the Coronation Cup as well, because there's so many horses in that race specifically at such short odds. I know you've been pushing Pile Driver and you've been pushing Dettori, but I'm always keen for an L each way shout, Jane.
I know, but I would be very slow to
you can dash my hopes,
way.
Jane. It's okay.
In a six-runner race, obviously, we need eight runners to have three places. Mm. And High Definition ran a huge race in the Tattersalls Gold Cup. But that's only 10 days ago, and he got a really hard race. So my question mark about High Definition is if he can back it up so close to having had such a grueling race at the Curra. If I'm going each way, I'll go in the Oaks, and I will go Concert Hall, because I think she's a filly that will really appreciate stepping up to a mile and a half. Her mother did it. Wouldn't be surprising if she could do well too.
Magic. Well, Jane Mangan, thank you very much for joining us. Pleasure as always. As Jane mentioned there, the Oaks is tomorrow, the Derby is on Saturday, so lots to look forward to in horse racing, but also lots to look forward to in golf. I'll be chatting to Greg Allen in a few moments' time.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on.
Golf.
Well, I'm delighted to say our own Greg Allen joins us now to chat golf. Greg, at the top of the show yesterday, I mentioned in our news headlines that former world number one Dustin Johnson will head the field for the inaugural $25 million LIV Golf Invitational Series event in England. The new Saudi-backed golf circuit confirmed that yesterday. Former British Open champion and world number 20 Louis Oosthuizen, former Masters champions Charles Schwartzel and Sergio Garcia, plus former US Open champions Graham McDowell and Martin Kaymer are also in the field. Now, you and I have spoken about what the effect this breakaway body may have on the PGA and if realistically how many big names the LIV tournament would attract to that side of things. Well, it seems the lure of many millions has won some notable figures over.
I think it's Rory McIlroy's correct in his assessment. He did a press conference over in Memorial at the tournament just after this was announced yesterday, and it says it's not a
field that you jump up and down about. This is the biggest prize fund in the history of tournament golf, 25 million. So it's 5 million more than the Players' Championship, which had just about everybody from the world's top 100. Even the tournament this week is vastly better field than this LIV event, and it's less than half the prize fund. That's going to be an offer next week in Hertfordshire. So you look at the prize or the field and you see Dustin Johnson. Yeah, that's a headliner. There's no question about it. Sergio Garcia, no longer a headliner, I don't think, really. I don't think Ian Poulter is either, or Lee Westwood. And you're looking at three players in their 40s, probably at that territory of their career when they are looking at possibly the Champions Tour. It's a bit early for Sergio to look that way, but his form wouldn't be one which would make him a favourite or even in the top 10 for a major championship right now. So it's a good field for a $3 million event on the European Tour, like, say, the Saudi International, which has been on the European Tour, not in this year nor last year, but it has been on the European Tour. So if this was a field for a European Tour event in Saudi Arabia on the regular DP World Tour, former European Tour, I'd say, yeah, it's pretty good. But for a $25 million event, it's grand. It's good. It's, you know, going to be interesting, that's for sure.
But if you have the headliner, say, like DJ that you mentioned there, so he'd be the one proper big name, I think it's safe to say. Do you think that might pave the way then for more big names? If we finally have one over the line, we might see more follow suit.
I would wonder about that, because Dustin Johnson is a bit of an outlier as a character. He just does his own thing. He doesn't really worry too much about reputation, doesn't get involved in very many press conferences where he says anything that's controversial or going to be taken down and newspaper is going to print it on the front page. He's just not that type of character. And I'm not so sure that he's at, you know, the peak of his career anymore. I think he may possibly be over the peak of his career. He's 37 now. Golf is increasingly a young man's game. Just look at the world's top 10. Like, Rory McIlroy looks positively old in the world's top 10 at 33, and we know he isn't, because he's one of the fitter athletes out there. Mind you, like Dustin Johnson, it's not a matter of fitness. He is one of the most athletic and fit guys on tour. But it doesn't look in the last year that he's at the world number one level that he was at, say, this time 2 years ago. In terms of form. So is he the headline act that, you know, a Rory would be? Or a really kind of top-end player like Morikawa, with young sort of vibe going on and pushing forward in the world rankings? Dustin is slipping in the world rankings. In February, Johnson basically nailed his colours to the PGA Tour, and I think people were surprised at the degree to which he did that. So how much money has been spent to make him change his mind? Rumours are that it's over $100 million. Rumours or whatever they are at the moment. We don't know for sure. I mean, I think a lot is going to unfold next week when this tournament gets up and running and we actually finally see it after it's been in gestation for so long in the minds of people in golf. Rory McIlroy did say one thing at the PGA Championship in Oklahoma 2 weeks ago, and that was that this is going to change golf. It's going to create leverage for golf. I mean, there's Dustin Johnson possibly holding out and maybe getting the biggest payout in the history of golf just to turn up for a tour which doesn't look like it's going to be terribly, you know, high-end in terms of the competitiveness.
It's not going to be overly captivating.
Well, we'll find out in the product. You know, I don't know. I haven't yet checked out how I'm going to watch it next week. I'm sure. I know that it's £67 sterling a day. So that's, what, €80 a day to go and watch this tournament, which is high.
Yeah.
That's what it costs to get into, say, an Open Championship thereabouts for a day. At least the last time I checked it, I suppose. So it would want to have an awful lot going on for that to be value for money. So do LIV investments care about that? Do they really just want to put on a show that's going to be different to what the product that we see week in, week out at the PGA Tour? Maybe they'll come up with a product which actually will change golf, but it'll do so in a matter of leveraging the PGA Tour to up their game in presentation on television, because I think that isn't a bad thing and not a bad notion.
Yeah, it's always good to have that competitiveness, I suppose. The PGA Tour Commissioner, Jay Monahan, came out fairly strong and has reportedly told agents of tour players prior to the Memorial Tournament, which we will get onto in a few moments, to either choose the PGA Tour or the LIV Golf Series Invitational. So playing on both circuits would not be an option. Are the PGA becoming increasingly worried about this threat, or, without putting words in your mouth, would there be more in your line of thinking that at the moment it's not overly offensive?
money is everything in this. And when you see figures of 30, 40 million being offered to players of the standard, say, of Ian Poulter, we believe that that was roughly the figure that was offered to Ian Poulter to join the Saudi League. Now, what's happening next week isn't the Saudi League. The Saudi League is a new concept which is yet to be established. But this is the next step to it.
Okay.
So when you see this amount of money, and all you do is look at that list and you see a lot of players in their 40s, Graham McDowell being one of them. You know, and I've spoken about Garcia, Poulter, Westwood, all in their 40s. Is this going to become this, the tournament between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour for over 50s? Dustin Johnson, no, he's miles away from that territory. But they needed one big name, and they've got Johnson. And how much does that cost? So I think, effectively, if the LIV investments just keep throwing more and more money the way of players, players will be attracted. And I think the outlier here and the interesting thing is that Phil Mickelson didn't sign on. Is that going to generate a couple of more zeros behind Phil Mickelson's paycheck for when he does sign on, if he does sign on? Because it looks as though Dustin Johnson, by nailing his colours to the mast of the PGA Tour last February and saying, I'm a PGA Tour player, I'm delighted to be on the PGA Tour, that LIV Investments came in with a bigger offer, that one that he just couldn't refuse. And then he started using the phrase of, I'm looking after my family, which a lot of people obviously have families which are badly in need of looking after.
Yeah.
Even though they've got, you know, obvious wealth beyond all of my dreams, maybe not yours, but certainly I don't necessarily think that the looking after your family when there's already 100 million in the bank is a viable sort of motivation.
But it's a narrative being pushed nonetheless. I do want to talk about the memorial tournament that is taking place at the moment. Seamus Power, Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy all in action. I know Seamus Power has completed his round. He finished tied 39th at the moment. He finished on par. How are other Irish players going? Shane Lowry tied 65th, one over through four, and Rory McIlroy, who teed off about an hour ago, certainly isn't under par anyway. So what will, I suppose, looking at the form these three guys are coming into the tournament in, and what would they be hoping to take out of this tournament as a whole?
We're in the middle of the major season. This is a big event. It's an elevated event on the PGA Tour, $12 million. This, along with the Genesis and the Arnold Palmer Invitational, have been elevated. This is part of the effect of the Saudi League threat and the LIV threat, that they have more tournaments to stopping points in the season, which are really elevated fields, and thereby elevated prize funds means better fields and more world ranking points. So this is a big tournament, but it's right in the middle of the heart now of the major season. We had the USPGA Championship 2 weeks ago. We have the US Open 2 weeks from now, and this is the biggest tournament in the middle. So it's a big event, but it's not a major. But it's still, for a lot of these players, for Rory especially, I think, it's getting back up on the horse after what was a pretty painful experience in Oklahoma, where he had the best chance that he had of winning a major, I think, since 2014. I saw him after his round of 65. There was an energy and a buzz about him, which we saw at the end of the Masters. So you see it at the end of the Masters, round of 64, round of 65 in Oklahoma. There's that buzz again, that jaunt in a step. And then it all went away with the second round of 71, when everybody around him, like Mito Pereira, 64, Bubba Watson, 63, Will Zalatoris, 65, they were all moving up and he was shooting a pedestrian 71. And the next day he shot a 74. And then he comes with a final round, big wind behind his sail, as he often does when he's not in contention, and shot a 68 to finish top 10. He needed something to get back up on a horse, and this is a good tournament for him to do so. But I'll be interested to see how he does. Back in 2014, he opened with a 63 and followed it with a 78, so I'm not so sure Muirfield is the golf course for him if he's struggling at all. But Rory's game is good at the moment.
Yeah.
But this event is, I think, just to answer your question, it's a big event, but it's a stopping point between the PGA and the US Open.
Okay, well, he's currently tied 65th. Likewise, Shane Lowry, they're both one over.
Yeah, they both bogey the first hole.
McIlroy's only through three holes and Lowry through four. Greg, I want to finish off with chatting the US Women's Open because Leona Maguire and Stephanie Meadow are both searching for a first major victory in the US Open, US Women's Open in North Carolina, the second women's major of the year, which tees off at the Pine Needles Golf Club for the fourth time, boasting a record prize fund of $10 million. Leona tees off at 10 past 7 and Stephanie's out in course as well. How would you rate both of their chances?
Well, Leona hasn't made a cut in the US Women's Open and she's had three attempts and she's on the back of some very ordinary form since her victory on the LPGA back in February. So just a tiny bit concerned about her form. She has been home with her coach over the last few weeks, Shane O'Grady, to try and sort out what it is that's not going well, because obviously at the end of last season she was one of the hottest players in the world. But golf is like that. It's a small ball game with the club head travelling at 100 miles an hour. Tiny things can go off and you can lose confidence. So let's just hope that the work that she has done over the last few weeks will get her back into that sort of mode. Stephanie Meadow has had a good season on the LPGA Tour already. Looks like her card is almost certainly going to be, you know, secured for next season, and we're only halfway through the season. So she's got a bit of form. And interestingly, back in 2014, Stephanie Meadow, in this very same part of North Carolina, just 10 miles away in Pinehurst, finished third in the US Open in her very first tournament as a professional. So fingers crossed she can carry some of that vibe into this week.
Okay, well, she's through two holes and she's one over at the moment. Greg Allen, thank you very much as always. Gentlemen, pleasure chatting all things golf. Sinead, that is all we have time for from this evening's Game On. I'll be back tomorrow from 6 p.m. But from all of the Game On team, it's bye for now. But do stay tuned to 2FM because Tara Kumar is up next.
RTE 2FM. On 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.